You're listening to the Body Literacy Podcast, your connection to the art and science of feeling really good, body, mind, and spirit. I'm your host and holistic health coach, Jen Mayo. If you've never experienced truth and freedom inside your body, an amazing adventure is about to begin. Healing happens in community. Body literacy is your tribe. Join me in discovering the keys to fearlessly unlocking your body's innate intelligence and resilience. Turn on to the wisdom of your body as we connect your wellness dots by exploring whole person healing, from neuroscience and nutrition to sexual health and sleep. Join the wellness revolution and start speaking your body's language. Before we get started, I wanted to introduce you to the most profound and impactful piece of health technology I've encountered in 3 decades of navigating my own health challenges. LifeWave is a wearable health technology that uses your own light energy to optimize your health. If you've followed the Body Literacy Podcast for any period of time, you likely already know that I'm a bit of a walking science experiment. I have a passion for exploring how time-honored ancient healing arts can be coupled with modern science and technology to optimize our health, wellness, and vitality, and how we can empower ourselves with the knowledge and optimization of our own onboard wisdom and healing potential, rather than viewing the human body as a problem to be solved. LifeWave's phototherapy patches use light to stimulate the body's natural healing systems. By applying LifeWave's non-transdermal patches to specific points on the body similar to acupressure, where the patch covers the skin, infrared light emitted from the body is reflected back into the tissue, stimulating specific regions of the brain and tapping into the body's own flow of energy and the ability to heal itself. LifeWave patches are not intended to treat any specific condition or disease, but rather support the body's own innate healing mechanisms. When we take a holistic approach to health and consider there is really only one state of dis-ease in the body, imbalance, rather than the 32,000 diseases defined by conventional medicine, rebalancing the body and supporting our own built-in capacity to heal becomes a journey of ease rather than a frustrating and disempowering struggle to control dis-ease. Energy medicine operates by a different set of rules than material medicine. I talk about experience-based medicine a lot, and LifeWave is simply a therapy you have to take for a test drive to feel the benefits for yourself. To learn more or try them out, just visit jenmayo.com/LifeWave. Dr. Keisha Ewers is an integrative medicine expert, doctor of sexology, family practice nurse practitioner, psychotherapist, herbalist, is board certified in functional medicine and Ayurvedic medicine, and is the founder and medical director of the Academy for Integrative Medicine Health Coach Certification Program. Dr. Keisha has been in the medical field for over 30 years. After conducting the HURT, or Healing Unresolved Trauma study in 2013, she developed the HURT model for understanding how past childhood trauma impacts adult health. This led to the creation of the You Unbroken online program for patients to heal their own trauma and the Mystic Medicine Deep Immersion Healing Retreat she leads at her home on San Juan Island in Washington State. Dr. Keisha is a popular speaker, including at Harvard and from the TEDx stage, and the best-selling author of Solving the Autoimmune Puzzle, The Woman's Guide to Reclaiming Emotional Freedom and Vibrant Health, The Quick and Easy Autoimmune Paleo Cookbook, Anti-Inflammatory Recipes with 7 Ingredients or Less for Busy People, and Your Libido Story, a workbook for women who want to find, fix, and free their sexual desire. You can listen to her Mystic Medicine radio show and find her programs at www.drkeisha.com. In this episode, Dr. Keisha and I explore the role of trauma in the development of chronic illness and autoimmune disease as an internal war that expresses itself in the physical body. Welcome to the show, Dr. Keisha.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you. So you wrote a wonderful book called Solving the Autoimmune Puzzle. And I know for me personally, it was one of my biggest aha moments in my own personal health journey, because you really filled in some key components that I think even when we were looking at functional and integrative medicine, they're leaving out
some really big pieces of the puzzle in terms of helping people navigate mind-body medicine. Would you mind giving us just kind of a little introduction into just your history and how you got into medicine and where you are today and what has helped you kind of evolve into the type of practitioner that is working from a space that's much more holistic and all-encompassing than maybe more mainstream avenues that people are familiar with?
Sure. So I always tell people it started when I was a 19-year-old registered nurse. I was kind of a high adrenaline junkie back in those days, like to skydive. I worked in the intensive care unit. I was raising I had four children during my 20s. And I was one of the, most driven people that I've ever met in my life. Actually, I was pretty tyrannical when it came to myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, my watch was always, if I would go running, I was competing against my own times. You know, I was going to Boston to run a marathon. It couldn't just be a marathon. You know, I had to, And I thought that was really fun in those days. You know, I thought that was like the measurement of fun was how much adrenaline that generate for myself. I wanted to be the perfect mother, the perfect wife, the perfect nurse, the perfect, you know, everything, right? When it came to spirituality, I tried to be really perfect. And so when I was in my early 30s, after a good decade of that, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. Okay. And, you know, this was, it doesn't happen this way, but it's the way my patients often tell their story too, where it's all of a sudden.
Right.
I went to bed one night and I was great. And then the next morning I woke up and I had 10 extra pounds of puffiness all over my joints. And it was like someone had taken the batteries out of the Energizer bunny. I was completely flattened.
Oh my gosh.
And in a lot of pain. And I used to pop ibuprofen like it was candy. Uh-huh. And so I took a bunch of ibuprofen and it didn't work. And I thought, oh, I better go in. And so I went in to see a doctor. And in the course of the history taking process, she asked me if there was a family history of autoimmune disease. And I said, yeah, I think my grandfather had rheumatoid arthritis and was wheelchair bound in the last part of his life. And he died in his 50s, actually at the age I am right now, I'm 57.
Okay.
And she said, well, here's a prescription for methotrexate. Here's one for a strong non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug. Come back when you get worse, not if.
Okay.
And we will change your meds. And I went, well, hang on. As she's leaving, you know, the office and, you know, I said, I'm really disciplined. I make my own food. I love to learn. Is there anything that, you know, is there some skill I'm missing that I need to be doing? And she said, no, it's genetic. You happen to just draw the short end of the genetic straw. And so on my way home, I remember thinking, my model of medicine doesn't have anything for me. Mm-hmm. So when I got home, I sat down at my computer, which in those days was a dial-up modem.
Right.
And started researching. And I found a compelling article on yoga and autoimmune disease. And the next day I was in my first yoga class ever.
Yeah.
And, you know, as is like yoga studio, right? You're holding your asana and the teacher's walking around talking. He was talking about Ayurveda, which was the sister science, the sister science of yoga. It's the medical arm of the Vedas. And it's 10,000 years old from India. And it was a brand new way of thinking about things that I was accustomed to. And he said enough that it piqued my interest. And I went home and looked it up on the computer again.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was a really interesting aha, because what they had to say was that we're not all the same. And there isn't one way of eating and sleeping and thinking that is right for every single person. And in fact, changes seasonally and throughout the seasons of your life. And I just remember thinking, wow, this is not anything that I've learned. Mm-hmm. And by the way, autoimmune disease is undigested anger, which was another revolutionary thought for me, because I'd never been exposed to the idea of digesting your feelings or your memories or experiences. You know, I just didn't have any concept of that.
Right.
So I decided that it was probably time for me to start to learn how to meditate. And one day in my newbie meditation, you know, new meditators always think that you're not supposed to have any thoughts. And so this word autoimmune kept jumping in front of me and I was trying to swat it away. Mm-hmm. And then finally I went, okay, let me look at this. Autoimmune. Mm-hmm. Oh, that means I'm doing it to myself.
Right.
Doing it to myself. And it's kind of a societally accepted way to commit suicide. And I thought, well, that's interesting because I don't want to die right mm-hmm. now. Is there a time in my life that I did? Which was actually a really important question for me to ask.
Right.
So I went backwards in my little breadcrumb trail of memories, and I came up with this 10-year-old girl version of myself that was mm-hmm. being sexually abused by the vice principal of the elementary school that I was attending.
Yeah.
And I saw her sitting there and I thought, oh, you did want off the planet. You really wanted off the planet. You didn't understand what was going on. Mm-hmm. I tried to tell a couple of teachers. I tried to tell my mom, but I didn't have like the right words. I've been a lot of years raised in Japan in the Navy, and we didn't have a television. I don't even think I knew what the word sex was or abuse
right.
last. I didn't know anything.
Right.
And so I think I just said that I don't feel safe, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, I thought, oh, this must be connected to this autoimmune disease. This has to be. And so I went straight into therapy and did some deep trauma work, and my RA reversed, went away, wow. like gone. And I never did take the medications, and it's not been back mm-hmm. ever since. And so from there I went, I need to go back to school. And so I went back to school and I got my nurse practitioner and got a master's degree in Ayurvedic medicine and got board certified in functional medicine. And then I was in private practice for about 3 months when I decided I need to go back and become a therapist. Like, you can't separate this mind from body thing.
Right.
So I started doing that. And then I got a PhD in sexology and I did a study called the Healing Unresolved Trauma Study.
Okay.
And from that emerged the HURT model in 2013. And it describes like what happens, you know, like we have in childhood these naive experiences, because when we're children, we're having all of our firsts, you know, as we're growing up, it's our first everything.
Right. Right.
And interesting enough, at 57, I'm starting on the downhill slide of the lasts, which is very fascinating to sit with. I'm like, oh, I'm on the lasts now. That's cool. That's interesting. So maybe treasure every moment, because you never know if it's your last, right?
Right.
It brings a lot of gratitude and appreciation.
Exactly.
So in the firsts, if you don't have a well-attuned, securely attached, wise, nonviolent communicating caregiver with you 24/7 to help you navigate some of the firsts that you don't understand, then your child mind, which does not have a prefrontal cortex fully engaged yet, because
right.
that doesn't happen until you're 26 years of age, and you're operating mainly from this limbic system. Am I enough? Am I okay? Am I doing it right? Am I safe? Am I lovable? Am I going to be part of the tribe? Are they going to kick me out? You know,
right.
smart enough, beautiful enough, all of the things.
Right.
So you're going to have these naive experiences, and then your whatever experience you have. So I'll just track, I call it tracking your hurt. We'll track my sexual abuse. So here I have this, like, get called into the vice principal's office. So you get this naive first experience. Something terrible happens. And so then you're going to get a feeling. Okay. So the first thing you get is a feeling about whatever experience you're having. For me, it was terror. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you're going to have a nervous system response. It's not going to be nervous system response first. It's feeling first. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then nervous system will respond. And we often describe that as your fight, flight, freeze, faint, sympathetic nervous system engagement. But actually, that's kind of a lie.
Yeah.
Because when you're children, you're powerless, you don't have autonomy, it's always freeze. Mm-hmm. You're not fighting anything and you're mm-hmm. not fleeing.
Right.
You actually have to stay put.
Right.
And because you're not autonomous, right? Mm-hmm. people tell you what you can and can't do, where you can go, what time, you know, what you have to wear, when to brush your teeth, all of these things.
Right.
So freeze state happens.
Interesting.
And then from there, you're going to instantly, because this is what we do from your child mind, and we do this in adult state too, but from your child mind at that stage, you're going to make up a meaning to what's happening. This is where that well-attuned, well-grounded, securely attached caregiver would be great to have in your back pocket.
Right.
There, right.
Right.
So, no, honey, this wasn't your fault, right?
Right.
Yeah. So because the vice principal was telling me it was my fault and I was a bad kid, then the meaning that I created was something's wrong with me.
Right.
Bad. And so then from meaning making, you'll create a belief system.
Yeah.
Now you have belief, right? So I have to actually be perfect to survive. If that, you know, like I have to be perfect to survive.
Right.
So then from there, you're going to create an adaptive behavioral response to match your belief and your meaning and your sympathetic nervous system arousal and your feeling. So the adaptive behavior for me was perfectionism.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, you've done this first initial hurt loop. Now the model bifurcates. Okay. You get these two other pathways that are possible once you have a fully developed brain.
Okay.
So adulthood.
Right.
And one side of it over here, it'll say in the middle of the loop process, it's an adaptive memory processing loop that you can engage in. You have a choice. And it says right in the middle of that, if you're willing to self-confront. Then you do the trauma work, you do the reframing, the re-engaging, the rewiring, all of those things, the forgiveness, all of that has to happen. That will then basically heal whatever is going on as a result of your looping process.
Okay.
Over here is the maladaptive memory processing, which means you do it how you did it when you were a child. And there's not a willingness to self-confront. You keep ruminating on the same automatic negative thought patterns. It forms judgment, you know, and you wind up getting sick from it. Mm-hmm. It causes autoimmunity and cancer and high blood pressure because it's, you know, every single time you get triggered, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll get triggered again and again and again. That first naive experience with the feeling and the nervous system arousal and the meaning and the belief and the behavior, that was what we could now call a button that you've got wired and set up that's on the outside of you that people can come along and push now for the rest of your life.
Right.
Unless you go and you snip the wires to it, and only you can do that.
Right.
So that's the hurt model, right? That's how I came to do what I do.
Okay.
It's because I would have, like, I did a TED talk called "Have You Heard from Your Libido Lately?" You know, when I'm coming into my practice saying I need bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, and then me saying, like, so what makes you think that?
Mm-hmm.
And them saying things like, well, my libido's gone, or there are a number of different reasons. I'm having hot flashes. I can't sleep. Can't remember anything. And then if it's libido related, me saying the next follow-up question, which is really logical and rational, do you like your partner? You know, like, I don't understand why people don't get asked these kinds of questions. Oftentimes, I would say 75% of the time, women with low libido that would come to see me for hormones and I would ask that question, they would start crying.
Mm-hmm.
And say, you know, he's been emotionally disconnected from me for years, or he had an affair 5 years ago and I've forgiven him, but I don't want to have sex with him, or he lost his job, he got a new job, he's never around. Like all of these different reasons that people will have.
Yeah.
But these are going to be perfectly matching to your trauma patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Parts of the brain that I discovered in my doctoral work, when I looked at hundreds of brain scans of women, this was so fascinating. The parts of the brain that light up on an fMRI with PTSD mm-hmm. are the same parts of the brain in a woman that are required for libido.
That is so fascinating.
If you're hijacked by stress, thinking that you're not getting a need met or whatever's going on for you, you're not going to have any libido.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, if a zebra is being chased by a lion and it thinks it's about to get eaten, it knows it's not safe to reproduce right now.
Right.
So, you know, it's very wise of the body to say, no, you're not going to do that. because we've got this over here. We're not surviving according to you. Right. And remember that this is perceptions. This is only perceptions. It's mm-hmm. not actually usually accurate. I mean, if you're in an unsafe, abusive relationship and it's accurate, then you need to get out. But if you're in a relationship where like, yeah, I really do love my partner, but I keep having these stress responses, these right. reactions, right? Then
right.
do some work with it. And I always say the same brain that creates the problem can't solve it. Like you can't witness yourself. We can't see ourselves.
Right.
We see everyone else's issues really well.
Right.
It's important to borrow a brain. Right.
Yeah. And I always talk about self-awareness being 95% of the equation. Is that really the first step for creating true root cause healing?
The willingness to self-confront is to me the first step. And then mm-hmm. integration is second. Okay. And so self-confrontation is important. And then the willingness to understand that your bias that you're probably looking outside and confirming all the time comes mm-hmm. from your trauma patterns. And so confirming your bias is not really going to bring self-awareness.
Right.
So self-awareness is coming from a reflection of those around you because you can't see yourself. That's right. Why borrowing a brain is important.
Right. And is that really where therapy comes into play? I know we'll probably talk a little bit more about trauma and doing more embodiment work and how talk therapy doesn't necessarily address that. However,
talk therapy does not work.
Right.
It does not work.
Let's in terms of releasing trauma from the body. Can you speak a little bit about, because I think this is, you know, when we start talking about mind, body medicine, you know, and there used to be the term like psychosomatic disease, which I think is kind of fallen out of the vernacular because I think it was a very misunderstood term where people thought that meant they were just imagining their symptoms. What we're now starting to understand, even through the lens of Western medicine, is that the mental and emotional aspects of our health feed directly into our endocrine system and our digestive system and our nervous system to create actual physical disease.
Yeah. So I love the term psychosomatic, and I would like to just have people create a different relationship with it because Ayurvedic medicine, again, 10,000 years ago.
Right.
So a couple of things that I'm going to bring up, but one of them is that the body is a canvas of the mind. Uh-huh. And the way that actually works, you know, in terms of the how what you just described happens is they describe five layers of us. So we have our physical structure, which they call your Anandamaya Kosha. These are five sheaths or Panchakoshas.
Okay.
So you have your physical structure that has your genes and your organs and your tissue layers and that, you know, all the things we want to feed and water and take for walks. Okay. And then what we have next to that would be our energy body.
Okay.
And this is your Pranamaya Kosha. Actually, in a couple of weeks, you know, our Healing the Energy Body Summit is coming out. And it's that layer that I'm talking about. Uh-huh. It's the one that we think of when we think of the chakra system. You
right.
know, and often if you go to a yoga class, you'll hear about seven chakras, which is a little self-limiting, actually.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
There are a lot of different frameworks and many different ways to think about chakras. But one thing that is accurate is that it's part of the energy body. And there are 72,000 of them, actually.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, we call them shrotas and nadis, channels. They're places where nerves cross. And this is how the information from the next body gets into the physical structure. So the one next to the energy body or the pranamaya kosha is the emotional body.
Okay.
So this is where we house our fears and our doubts and our feelings and all of the historical record of all of those too. And so when you come along and someone pushes that button and you go straight into the same looping cycle again, it's as if you're doing it fresh. It's the same button. Mm-hmm. And that information's being channeled through these energy channels into your physical structure. Okay. And so this is why there's a lot of emphasis right now on the vagus nerve, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which is again, a little bit like talking about the roof of the house and not addressing the water leaks in the basement. So
right.
like, it's just so interesting how we just really want to focus upstream and not look at the root.
Right.
And so the vagus nerve, very important, you know, the wandering nerve, it goes through most of the organ systems and goes up and down, you know, up your whole spine. Really, really a good place to talk about and have some focus on. However, it is actually getting tracking what your initial meanings that you put to your events that is the most important, because then you still have a wire. So dealing, you know, like your button is still there. Right. So if all you're doing is having that button pushed and then going to work on the vagus nerve or tapping yourself out of an emotional
response,
then you're still in a space where you can get triggered, right?
Of
learning the post-traumatic growth that can come from post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. So while tapping is fantastic and vagal nerve stimulation is wonderful, if you have gotten swamped, right, it'll help you to get out of that swamping.
Right.
But at the end of the day, what we really want is to drain the swamp.
Yeah. Right.
So that you're not getting engaged in that way, that you have resilience.
Right.
You have an understanding that you are not the reduced nature of what your ego says you are.
Right.
Now that your roles or your gender or your political affiliation or your religion or your whatever, your skin color, like all the things we fight about. You are not any of that, you know?
Right.
And so that's the thing is moving into a vaster understanding of who you actually are.
Right.
And then it's like the elephant in India that's going down the through the village on the dirt trail, his or her, you know, ears are just flapping and he's just going like this. And all these little dogs from the village are coming along and going, you know, and trying to chase the elephant out, you know,
right.
The village, and the elephant's just like, doesn't even notice them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like got complete power, you know, these little yappy dogs mean nothing to them, right?
Right. Like, right.
So you're having your experience. That's okay.
Right.
You know? Like, and I'm going to keep on moving. Right.
Right.
This really steady, grounded way, you know? And so it's a really lovely image to pull up and think like, how often my yappy dog versus an elephant?
You know? Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about big T versus little T trauma?
Yeah. So little T trauma, we have hundreds and hundreds of examples of those that we go through as we are growing up. Big T trauma is the stuff that we think about when we hear trauma. So it'll be domestic violence and sexual abuse and psychological neglect and spiritual abuse and watching a parent be a victim of domestic violence or having a parent that is addicted to a substance or mentally ill or incarcerated or dies when you're a child or even divorce, right? Mm-hmm. So these are big T traumas that we usually associate with neglect and abuse.
Yeah.
Little T traumas are the things that are just part of childhood.
Okay.
I always say childhood is a jungle. It's full of them. Little T trauma monkeys flying all the way through the jungle.
Right, know? Right.
And, you know, these are biologically wired to understand that if we're put on the outside of the firelight circle in our tribal days, that the saber-toothed tiger could eat us. And so it's important that we're accepted by the tribe, that we feel like we are deserving and worthy of being in the tribe and of value in the tribe. So if we have any experiences, and we all have them, that are feelings of rejection or betrayal, or like we don't belong. Those are little T traumas, and they are experienced by the nervous system and the brain as trauma.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's accompanying meanings and beliefs and adaptive behaviors that become maladaptive in adulthood.
Right. And so it's more how we experience the experience rather than what the definition of the experience actually is.
With the meaning we attach to it.
Okay. The meaning that you attach to it. Okay.
Yeah. And then the behavior that we then attach to the meaning and belief. Yeah.
Right.
I'll give you an example. I give this one a lot because it was so compelling and it's easy to track. So I live in Seattle and there's a great big software company here that's quite famous. And there was a guy that came to see me. He was in his early 40s and he'd been to see a lot of doctors and he had hyperhidrosis. You know, he sweat every time he got in front of, he had social anxiety and he would just sweat out his shirts.
Okay.
And it would drip down his face and he would turn red, and it was just humiliating for him to get up in front of his peers, which his job required to present his work. And so he'd had Botox injections in his sweat, you know, in his axilla, and to try and stop the sweat. He had been put on beta blockers. He'd been given anti-anxiety medications, the usual.
Yeah.
And nothing had worked. And so he'd heard about me and he came to see me. And so when I started working with him in our first appointment, I got to this place with him where we discovered that when he was in middle school, he was walking through the cafeteria with his tray of food and he had tripped and fallen like splat.
Okay.
And his tray clattered and his food went everywhere. And
oh, it was no.
of the table where the girl he had a crush on was sitting, and everybody erupted in laughter.
Oh,
in the cafeteria, as would happen. I mean, that's just how it works, right?
And that would be mortifying at that age.
Yeah. So, I mean, for sometimes people would jump up and they would become the class clown.
Right.
Something out of that. Right. So it's like, what's the meaning? What's the meaning that you attach to it? So his feeling that he got was intense shame. Mm-hmm. And he froze, of course. And then the meaning that he attached to it was that he was too clumsy to be in front of people. And so that became his belief, is that he needed to become invisible. And mm-hmm. so his adaptive behavior that he attached to that was to hide. He never even, all the way through the rest of middle school, high school, college, undergrad, and graduate school, and at lunch in his, you know, in the job that he had on that campus, never entered another cafeteria.
Oh, wow.
And he would eat in the library and study while he was eating. And that became his adaptive behavior. Now, why I say adaptive behaviors often are maladaptive in adulthood is because most of the time they are. So here he is required by his job to stand up in front of large groups of people and present his work.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, his 12-year-old is saying, no, we don't do that. Right. Because everyone will laugh at us. We are idiots in front of groups.
Uh-huh.
And so like these parts of him are all chiming in and saying, no, his protector, his judge. And so what we did was healed that little boy, right? We went in and we created a securely attached man to his boy. And I gave him a way of going, and if every time this would pop up, we create a calm, safe place within him that he could go grab his little kid self and give him what he needed from a securely attached, well-attuned caregiver at that moment and didn't have, which mm-hmm. was, come on, everybody falls down. Come on, let's clean this up. All of you that are laughing, come up and help clean up the food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've all done stuff like this, you know, like some kind of corrective experience.
Right.
And so he has to provide corrective experiences for himself now. And lo and behold, it all went away.
No
more hyperhidrosis. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's the meaning you attach to the experience.
Got it.
I just wanted to take a quick minute out of today's episode to tell you about ZRT Laboratories at-home hormone testing. ZRT has 20 years of experience and is a leader in innovative, safe, and meaningful hormone and wellness testing. When produced in balance, your symphony of hormones determine optimal mental and physical health and functioning, including healthy weight management and metabolic functioning, mood, libido, fertility, energy, and sleep quality, as well as how they contribute to the creation or avoidance of chronic health conditions. To keep things functioning at their best, the body must constantly fine-tune hormone release to keep levels within proper limits. An imbalance in one system can cascade into imbalances in others, which is why the diurnal saliva cortisol test is the cornerstone of the body literacy method for understanding how stress and trauma set the stage for hormone imbalances that affect your health, wellness, and vitality. Visit the Body Literacy Shop today to purchase our ZRT Laboratory at-home cortisol saliva test and other at-home hormone test kits available to help you get to the root cause of your health and wellness challenges. Shop online at shop.bodyliteracy.me and enter the discount code PODCASH at checkout for $10 off your purchase of $100 or more. And now back to today's episode.
In the book, you talk a lot about the ACEs study. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah. So between 1995 and 1997, the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente conducted this really big study, the largest of its kind, over 3,500 participants that were all Kaiser enrollees. And how it came to pass was Kaiser had this really great weight loss program in their clinics, successfully helping people get down to the weights they wanted to be. And there was a percentage, especially women, who were dropping out before they completed. Even though they were successfully losing weight, they would drop out before they got to their goal. And so luckily, the head of the clinic decided to be curious and called them back in and asked questions and found that many of them had been sexually abused in childhood.
Okay.
And so that became the little head scratcher, like, what's this about? And so they conducted this study called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And they said, before the age of 18, did you experience any of these things? And they were capital T traumas.
Okay.
And if you said yes to one, that was an A score of one. If you said yes to two, then that was two, so on. And what they found, and you know, the findings of this scale, this large scale study, are still being unpacked.
Yeah.
But some of the most compelling ones that I discovered, in fact, the most compelling one that I found was that people with higher A scores are less inclined to engage in self-care consistently.
Okay.
And I thought, well, that's interesting, you know, to be able to stay on a program. A lot of people will say, well, I self-sabotage, like I'll get to a certain point and then I get bored or tired of it and I don't want to do it anymore. And I just throw it to the wind. Mm-hmm. And if I mess up one day, then I just go down in flames, you know? And so that's actually very much associated with an ACE score. And then the other findings were, if you have an ACE score of six or more, your likelihood of living 20 years young, you know, less than your counterparts that don't have ACEs score.
Oh, wow. That's 20 huge. Years. Yeah.
Really big. And then the higher your ACEs score, the higher your risk for all the chronic illnesses that we have today, heart disease, cancer, autoimmunity, genetic expression that leads to disease, habits that are not life promoting, but are more self-destructive.
Right.
Yeah. So that's something that doesn't carry with it a set in stone outcome, though. Like in my book, I say, so now you have your ACEs score. Now what? This doesn't mean that these outcomes have to be yours. The good news, and I always write and teach about things that always have a solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Never like to talk about something and say, well, you're screwed. You know, that's it. So the thing about this is that you can change that outcome. It doesn't need to be your reality. It's just, if it's never confronted, if you never investigate your own self, your own ways of perceiving, mm-hmm. and heal, then that's your likely outcome.
Right. Right. Very interesting. Can you talk a little bit maybe about epigenetics and why it is? I think, you know, especially a few decades ago when they did kind of crack the genetic code, you know, that was obviously a big discovery in the scientific community and certainly fascinating. But I think after that, so much emphasis was put on genetics being destiny. And I think what we're now starting to understand, you know, with this term epigenetics, is that's really just a blueprint. How do genetics interplay with a more empowered model of medicine where we do have control over the expression of those genes?
This is an interesting question. How you phrased it, I'm going to zoom in on.
Okay.
You know, because I love it. Like, okay. It's a really good question.
Good.
And the idea that you can control your genetic expression is false.
Okay.
You cannot control your genetic expression.
Okay.
And that is one of the trauma patterns. I mean, you know, if I always say, if you find someone that's psychic, highly sensitive, an empath, intuitive, and a control freak, you're finding someone that's been traumatized.
Uh-huh.
They have trauma in their background, Right. Because you've learned how to tune into all of these different frequencies as a need, like you had to, right? And so you have all these skills as a result. So cool. And at the same time, there's also a very deep desire to control things.
Yeah. Right. So, right.
So I'm just going to go in on the word control.
Okay.
And sometimes people will get very frustrated because in functional medicine, sometimes it's portrayed like epigenetics is that you can control your genetic expression, and that is false.
Okay.
What it does is it lowers the risk that you will express your genetics as disease.
Okay.
It doesn't guarantee it.
Right.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So we'll talk a little bit about epigenetics here, but I just want to like make that so that I'm not making any claims that people are hearing. I don't ever say I help people cure their autoimmunity. I say uh-huh. them reverse it.
Yes.
Because I could get rheumatoid arthritis back in 6 months. I know I could.
Right.
I have it in my genetics.
Right. Right.
And so if I were to go back to thinking the way that I thought, and I would certainly, I could get it back.
Right.
So it's like, there's this constant interplay between you and your environment and your thoughts and your lifestyle choices.
Mm-hmm.
And your genes are definitely a blueprint, as you said, like this right. is sort of the architectural design. The construction of your building, you know, that you have the blueprint for, you have a lot of choices in. Sometimes the weather comes and blows your roof off.
Right, right.
Right. And so sometimes there's still going to be a genetic expression that isn't one that you think that you can turn off, right? So people will talk about turning off and on their genes. That's another misnomer. That's
okay.
not actually how it works. Okay.
Okay.
So I talk about the freedom framework in solving the autoimmune puzzle. And I talk about everybody being an individual puzzle. Like everybody's different. We're all different. Just literally like snowflakes. We're each different.
Yeah.
And so when we think about it that way, then that means there's no one way of getting sick and there's no one way of getting well.
Right.
So we have to approach it like we're puzzles. And so I talk about these four corner pieces of what I call the freedom framework, you know, okay. solving your puzzle. And so the four corner pieces are genetics.
Okay.
And the second corner piece would be your gut health. And the third is your toxic load and your body's willingness to get rid of those toxins. And then uh-huh. the fourth is trauma and how you do stress today.
Okay.
So genetics as one of the corner pieces is influenced by the other three,
mm-hmm.
your trauma, right? And how you have managed to deal with it or not. If you're still in a stress response reactivity. So between stimulus and response, if there's a lot of reactivity,
yes,
that can actually generate genetic expression towards disease.
Okay.
All right. And if you have a big toxic burden, okay, and that can be viral, it can be bacterial, it can be fungal, it can be all of the chemicals we have in our environment today, you know, so we have a lot of different choices for
sure.
toxic burden.
Right.
That will also influence how your genetics express themselves. And then you also have gut health, and everyone with autoimmune disease has leaky gut. That's just how it works.
Okay.
Assume that to be true. And then from there, you know, how far down the road have you gotten to being intolerant mentally, emotionally, and physically? Because then if you have a lot of sensitivities, that means you're intolerant, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so are you intolerant of your environment and people in it and your life experiences, et cetera? That will influence how your genetics express themselves. So all these are epigenetic factors. So yeah. it's often reduced down to, I think Dr. Oz said it, like genetics load the gun and then your lifestyle choices pull the trigger.
Right, right.
Yeah, we've heard that. Or the key that unlocks the genes, what's above it. But I'll say it's so much more nuanced than that. It's thought to thought.
Right.
It's rarely talked about that your thoughts are what are pulling their trigger.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
I think I've heard it referred to before me as Dr. Mark Hyman was saying, you know, be careful what you think because every cell in your body can hear what you're thinking, you know, and then it ends up expressing that way. Would a better way of phrasing it be that our thoughts and our lifestyle choices can upregulate or downregulate the gene expression?
Yeah. I mean, a gene, right? So not all of them are programmed toward disease.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, yeah, you can definitely say that. These are simplifications that are nice because you can kind of put your head around that and go, yeah. So if I'm having thoughts that are life affirming, then I'm more likely to have my genetics that are designed for wellness be upregulated. Mm-hmm. I'm having thoughts that are life destructive, you know, victimization, scarcity, et cetera, then I'm more likely to be creating resentment in my system, which is the most toxic chemical there is on the planet, mm-hmm. not manufactured by great big corporations and thrown into the air, water, and soil, but by us.
Just internally.
Our cells are bathing in that.
Right.
Then your genetics are more likely to have ones that are programmed for disease upregulated.
Right. Right. Okay. That makes perfect sense. You kind of talked earlier about this idea of autoimmunity being almost like a chronic form of suicide, where we're internally at war with ourselves. You know, with that framework, would you say on, you know, a psycho-spiritual and emotional level, is self-love the antidote to turning off that mechanism in ourselves?
Yeah, it's definitely the path rather than the antidote, right?
Okay.
So the path in is with compassion and curiosity, like where you start self-confronting with compassion and curiosity and going, hey, I noticed you're trying to give me some information here and I would like to know more rather than shut up, stop doing that. I'm going to give you ibuprofen because you're hurting, you know, like how come you won't just do it? I mean, I've been starving you for 2 weeks. Why haven't I lost a pound? You know, and it's just like, it's viewing the body as an inanimate object. You know, it's the tyranny of the mind instead of really knowing, realizing, and embodying that the heart has its own wisdom, the belly mind has its wisdom, right? The body itself and all of the components within the body. A lot of times people just say body, but you know, like your right shoulder has its own wisdom, right? What does your I mind say to you right now? In Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about six minds, that you have these six minds and they are each taking in information separately. They won't do it at the same time. So in other words, if I'm looking at your background and I say it's gray, then I can only take in that one little bite of information. I won't be able to hear you at the same time. But because we do it so quickly, it looks like we're doing everything simultaneously. So we're taking in information through the five senses.
Right.
And then the larger mind is synthesizing them.
Right.
And this is an 18-step process called perception. Mm-hmm. And how we've done it before is how we're going to do it forever, unless we slow it all down and create not a Japanese bullet train of thought, but a little locomotive that's going along and you can see between the cars. You know, these are all our thoughts. Like you can start witnessing your thoughts.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And being able to start taking self-responsibility for them. You know, and when you can do that and recognize that the brain and nervous system neurologically are a giant reducing valve that make it so we can only see so much of the light and sound available around us all the time. It's why God said to Moses, like, I have to appear to you in a burning bush because otherwise you'd be thermonuclear waste puddle here on the ground. Or, you know, there's the Vatican ceiling where Adam and, you know, and God are just touching fingers, because any more than that, and we can't handle it.
Right.
And Kundalini rising, right? We have to go through strengthening of our nervous system before we can contain that much energy, et cetera. There's all kinds of frameworks for understanding this. When we die, people that have come back, I've had a couple of near-death experiences. And when you die and your brain and nervous system reducing valve is now gone, all you see is intensely bright light. Mm-hmm. It's so bright. Like you can't even describe it with words.
Right.
And the sound is loud. So you realize like that nervous system has been filtering and now it's gone. That's what's actually out there around mm-hmm. us all the time that right. our brain and nervous system are constantly reducing. And then our child mind has put in labels to some of the ways that we keep reducing ourselves. And so that we see ourselves as, I don't know, whatever our educational level is, our gender, our skin color, our, like I said earlier, you know, our political party, our religion, et cetera. And so we continue reducing ourselves down to something that's so tiny and infinitesimal. It's just like this little tiny whatever. And then we think when somebody offends us, that's us, right?
Right.
Instead of the vastness of who you really are is not contained in this body. This is like Rumi said, you know, it's borrowed clothes that you're wearing, the body. Right. And who you really are is this aware and a love, like your unconditional, vast, luminous light love. Mm-hmm. And so that can't be offended. That can't be wounded. That can't be, you know, like there's nothing you can do to that. It's
right.
Yeah. And so when you reach like post-traumatic stress can reach toward post-traumatic growth if you're willing.
Right.
You're willing to engage in that. And that growth is the realization of who you really are, right? Yeah. The vastness of who you really are. And so then these trauma patterns, that's why healing them is so important. Mm-hmm. Because you start realizing like, oh, the meaning I put there, I reduced myself down even further. Mm-hmm. If I'm always looking to see if I'm safe, then I've brought my life down to this tiny little speck. Mm-hmm. Right. And then I can't shine and bring the brilliance of the unique individual that I am, of the, I call it the fractal of God, the facet of God that you are. Mm-hmm. Right. And so then you alone are doing that to yourself.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting.
I don't know if I wandered off the question.
Oh, no, that's okay. I love I love tangents. They always take us to some interesting
things. I wandered right off the question.
So you're actually a doctor of sexology, correct? Mm-hmm. Yes. Tell us, you know, a little bit more. What does sex have to do? I know you touched on libido a little bit earlier, but in the grand scheme of understanding our energetic expressions and how that fits into trauma, what does sex have to do with it?
Very little.
Okay.
Okay. But in our English language, so this mm-hmm. goes back to Ayurveda. In Ayurvedic medicine, they have this term. Chinese medicine has a similar one. They call it ojas. Mm-hmm. And ojas is life force vitality. And when I was really engaged in learning Ayurvedic medicine, they have these three energies called prana, tejas, and ojas. And in autoimmune disease, the air or communication part of prana has been interrupted by tejas. It's burned a gap in the bridge. So the communication from cell to cell is now inflamed. Tejas is fire.
Okay.
And so then that interrupts ojas, like your life force vitality.
Okay.
And so as I was thinking about that, I thought, gosh, you know, we don't have a word for ojas.
Right.
We just don't. And I thought libido mm-hmm. is as close as we can get. It's that life force vitality that we have, that libido comes from a Latin word that is actually desire, desire, and it means from the stars. And so
that's nice.
Yeah, it's our birthright, actually. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's part of what we're here to do, to be, to engage in is what is your dharma, your passion, your life purpose, your mission? It's from the stars, right? As we come in, we have our astrological setup, we have our dosha setup, we have our human design, like all these things that are unique to us that comes from the stars. And so, you know, as we bring ourselves in as cosmic beings and put them in this particular body, then what interrupts that? Trauma. And so that's what got me interested in, and I'm the mother of functional sexology. I'm the one that coined that term. And I thought, you know, functional sexology needs to be talked about. And I've talked to to IFM a million times about starting a module for this because I'm one of the educators there. And so far we don't have one.
Okay.
But it's the idea of, you know, finding and fixing whatever block to flow that you have in that life force vitality. What do you reduce down to? What do you get, you know, your hose kinked? What is it that interrupts that flow?
Right.
And that's what we're looking for, right? And it's always going to be you. It's not anyone else. It's what the meanings are that you attach to early experiences that now you hold dear to you as truth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I'm not good enough. I'm not worth protecting. I'm not deserving of love. I'm not right. I'm not beautiful enough. All men are bad. All women are bad. They're going to leave me. I'm going to get hurt. Like, you know, these all have evidence to support them.
Right.
All of our beliefs do. And then there's also, if we open up the reducing valve and start looking with a wider view and move into a wider stage of development. We have 10 stages of development in adulthood. So we go from a concrete black and white child state of, right, all the way into unitive consciousness. Humans, less than 1% ever get there before they die of unitive state.
Yeah.
So, and yet most of them think they do get there. So it's a state where you realize like, oh, I'm that vastness. I'm co-creator in everything that's going on. I'm realizing that any of the dramas and traumas that occur are happening for me, through me, as well as to me. Mm-hmm. And what is it that I'm supposed to be learning and developing my, you know, my post-traumatic growth from. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, this is why we engage in healing trauma. This is what it has to do with sex is, you know, libido. Your libido can be used sexually, but also it can be channeled to anything you want.
Right.
Right. And so there are plenty of spiritual lineages and traditions who become celibate, but you know, one of the things that that often goes sideways about that, and you'll be able to see in different environments, like who is in this space, is if you're a dried up husk and you don't have any life force vitality flowing through you and you're celibate, like nothing's going to happen, right? You have to have that life force vitality, that energy system that's nice and primed and open to be able to hold that unconditional love, that awareness, right?
Right.
So this is where healing trauma is absolutely paramount. You can't do it if you're reducing you.
Right.
And planting those channels off.
Right.
This is why I became interested in this.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. There's a doctor, I think his name is Dr. Jim Hopper at Harvard Medical School. He's a clinical psychologist who has done a lot of work surrounding traumatic memory and why it is that so many people who have had traumatic experiences either have a very fragmented recollection of it or no recollection of it at all. Can you speak a little bit to why that is, and how does one go about addressing trauma if they don't have a conscious awareness of it?
Yeah, that's a really frequently asked question that I get is, what if I don't remember my childhood? And, you know, the fragmentation of memory or the protection, the protective veil that gets put in there is because your mind doesn't think it can manage it, right? And so when you get yourself into a space where like you're with a good therapist, you're working in an environment where a safe holding container has been created and there's trust established, and we're working with trauma techniques, then that can slowly unfold itself. The mind doesn't usually allow it to go faster than it can manage. So that's what's so beautiful about it. It's your own reducing valve. You reduce it down so that you don't have to deal with it day in and day out. But problem is it's like a little popcorn machine under there. It's popping.
Right.
Trouble sideways in other areas of your life, you know? So that's when people start coming to me and saying, all right, I think there's something going on because I can't seem to whatever it is, like whatever it is that they're trying to achieve or manifest, or the happiness level they're trying to, you know, attain is just elusive. And it's because the, you know, those little kernels of trauma are still in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think too about the nature of modern medicine? Because I had a recent conversation actually with a comedian named Tony Naj in a previous episode where we talked about the fact that it's kind of become revealed in the mainstream at this point that it's been common practice where medical students have been allowed to practice pelvic exams and pap smears on anesthetized patients. And until recently, that's been legal to do so. That's starting to change, obviously, for good reasons. But with regards to like mainstream medicine and some more, not sure the right way to put it, but the more yang approach to how medicine is practiced in Western medicine sometimes tends to be more abrasive and kind of that fragmented, like we talked about before. So this dualistic idea that, you know, we're a collection of different body parts, where do you see the solution? You know, and I love using the term we medicine, where Western and Eastern are starting to come together. I think it's a slow process, but it is starting to happen. How do we as a solution start to incorporate more of those time-honored traditions? I know you had mentioned, you know, some of these Eastern philosophies are as old as 5 or 10,000 years old. And I don't think many people realize that our current iteration of modern Western medicine is really only about a century or so old. How do we kind of integrate this so we have a more holistic model moving into the more mainstream model of medicine?
Yeah. So this is a great question. And I believe it has to do with each individual practitioner, not medicine as a whole.
Sure.
So developmental state of where we are, who we are is who we show up as. And so when I teach, you know, like for the Institute for Functional Medicine or the health coaches through the Academy for Integrative Medicine, you know, it's a transpersonal program. Like you do this work.
Yeah.
Because then you show up in a more expanded state of development. And then you're going to bring with you that level of compassion.
Yeah.
So if you're still in a space that's contracted down to black and white success orientation that looks a certain way, and that's where you're motivated from, then it's going to look very different from someone that has engaged in the work of self-compassion, right? And healed their own trauma.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. And you talked a little bit about the microbiome earlier, but can you expand a little bit more on like what the enteric nervous system is and why is gut health in particular such a big component in like root cause healing?
Well, I mean, we know that our microbes are 100 trillion strong and they outnumber the rest of the cells in our body by 10 to 1. So we're not the host, they are.
Yeah.
And so, however, you know, that's why we can look at it upside down and say, well, our microbiome is influencing our mood and our weight and our immune system, but actually it's not.
Yeah.
Right. It's they're hosting us. And so if they're not working together, like in an ecosystem that is collaborative and it's in a combative space, then we're going to have the downstream repercussions of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And can you clarify too, just for anybody listening who doesn't know what leaky gut is? So you did mention that earlier, and how does that impact the overall picture?
Yeah, so that's intestinal permeability. And what that means is that the one cell layer thick lining that runs through your digestive tract and any hollow area in your body, including your arterioles and veins and nares and, you know, eustachian tubes and any any tube, right?
Yeah.
Has one cell layer thick lining. If that is compromised and those cells pull apart, then what is supposed to stay on the inside of that tube can start working its way out. And then the immune system, quite rightly, starts investigating, like, I'm designed to attack anything that's not me. So if I see something show up outside here that's not me, then I'm supposed to engage with it. So the immune system's not doing anything wrong.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right. And you've talked a little bit about perfectionism and people pleasing. Why is it so often that we see autoimmune disease showing up more often in people who fit those profiles?
So I always say that there are four P's in autoimmunity: people pleasing, perfectionism, holding on to the poison of past pain, and also the Pitta dosha from Ayurveda.
Okay.
So these are, you know, these people pleasing and perfectionism are some of those behaviors I talked about, right? Mm-hmm. That we say, okay, this is what I need to do in order to fit the belief system that I've created according to this event in my life. And then, of course, holding on to the poison of past pain is one of those things that we are wired to do. We, in our early tribal days, we had to remember where the saber-toothed tigers lived, where the poisonous berries were, right?
Right.
And so it's just learning how to make sure that we're saying, okay, so I can remember that without it governing my nervous system.
Right, right. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Well, this has been great, Dr. Keisha. I really appreciate you joining us. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience that you think would benefit them in their own health journeys?
I would just say to engage in that 24-hour self-witnessing, right? Where you really start investigating your own thoughts, the tone, the quality of them, you know, the themes, and see what you find out. You know, start slowing the train of thought down, really watching it, and then notice where it might be. You can add a little self-compassion in instead of a really harsh judge.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, this has been a great conversation. If people would like to learn more about your programs and your website, where can they find you online?
DrKeisha.com. DrKeisha.com.
Okay, great. And you've got a lot of great programs on there that people can do at home as well as in-person experiences.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful.
I actually do plant medicine retreats, trauma healing retreats, and then and some online programs and a health coaching program, and then work one-to-one with patients too.
Great. Great. Well, I will include all of those in the show notes so people can reference them if they'd like to get in touch with you. But thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. And I really appreciate all your wisdom and information. And I think our audience will too.
Thank you so much.
Yes, no problem.
Bye, everybody.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Any statements and views expressed by myself or my guests are not medical advice. The opinions of guests are their own, and the Body Literacy Podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. If you have a medical problem, please consult a qualified and competent medical professional. As always, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Body Literacy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe and sign up for updates over at jenmayo.com.